I think that if we can create good jobs and healthy companies and people's creativity can thrive, then we're going to live in a better world.
Hi, everyone. I'm Amy Devers, and this is Clever. Today, I'm talking to business consultant Holly Howard. Holly is one of these exceptional folks who appears to be in full command of both her right brain and left brain. She brings her many creative talents to her work, helping creative entrepreneurs grow their businesses without sacrificing their souls. Named Ask Holly How, she describes her business consultancy as culture first and founded on the principle that successful entrepreneurship resides at the intersection of self-evolution, business growth, and the creative pursuit. If that sounds like music to your ears, does to mine, it's no accident. Prior to founding Ask Holly How, Holly was a board-certified music therapist. She also plays the bassoon, has been a medical researcher, a professional ballet dancer, and a VP of operations and finance. All of this adds up to a suite of skills, experience, and knowledge that she deploys in the name of helping creatives thrive. Since founding Ask Holly How in 2012, she's worked with over 1,000 businesses, has taught at Pratt and RISD, and hosts a podcast called Cultures Within Capitalism. As you'll hear, Holly has a perspective on business growth that is as refreshing and creative as it is immediately revelatory and actionable. No wonder, she's been on every side of the equation and knows the best place to look for answers is on the inside. Here's Holly.
My name is Holly Howard. I'm the founder of Ask Holly How, and I am located in Brooklyn, New York. I think creativity, beauty, and design is truly like a form of hope, and I love being able to facilitate that.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
That just gave me hope hearing you say that. I think it's so true because art inherently has to cast a vision that doesn't exist. And so it has to come from a place of hope because you're, even if the art is provocative or traumatic or repulsive, it's hope that by going through that, you can recover or you can offer some sort of healing gravitas that sometimes can't just be worked out through language. It needs to bypass language in order to touch you, pull the strings of your souls in a really magical way.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I am also not surprised to hear you say that, considering running a culture-first business consultancy means that you are actively engaged on the day-to-day with creative entrepreneurs, helping them solve problems, but orient themselves and clarify their mission and grow their business so that they can actually participate in the creative process in a healthy way and a sustainable way, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think I love that you said that because that's what I try to emphasize. Oftentimes there seems to be a divide between like creativity and business. And people will even express that, well, I'm the creative side, I'm not the business side. And I try to help people understand that the business side is actually there to facilitate your creativity. Structure is there to facilitate creativity. And so if you can really embrace that, then you can really indulge in the creative process. But when we resist that, it's actually when we have a hard time indulging in the creative process.
Yes. Or if we just try to power through and do the creativity thing, but without the business structure, what I think happens, and I'm kind of speaking for myself, is you end up kind of treading water. I've heard you talk. I've listened to some of your podcasts, and you have a lot of really, really wonderful resources on your website. So I think that's very generous. And I've heard a little bit about your background. I know that you grew up in the Midwest and then became a ballerina and then went into music therapy. And I want to talk to you all about that because I can tell how that informs the way you think about business. But going back to the very heart of the matter is, why do we have this cultural narrative, the starving artist narrative that sort of confounds creatives to the point that they can't even really see a future for themselves that is thriving?
Yeah, I don't know where the narrative comes from. And I think it's so sad. And I was giving somebody an example of it this week when I started. So I'm about 12 years in now. I'd gone to a meeting. It was of this organization called the Freelancers Union. And in the meeting, somebody said, well, you know, freelancers, it's always feast or famine. And I remember in that moment thinking, is it? I don't think it's going to be. And I've never had a famine. And it's just interesting to me that, like, you know, we adopt these mindsets without questioning them. And I think that big one of like the starving artists, or like to be an artist, you can't make money, you know, you can't be business savvy. I hear a lot of people say like they're creative, so they're not numbers focused, like a lot of divided mindsets. And I don't know where it comes from. You know, I don't know the origin, but I think it's so unfortunate that we're so quick to adopt it without questioning it.
I don't know where it comes from either, but I mean, I can sort of patch together a collage of my own experience that I think is pretty relatable. Other people have the same thing, but I'm middle-aged now and my parents were silent generation. You know, I was sort of raised in a family where hard work and academics were really emphasized. And the way to measure success was grades. And the epitome of success was getting a good job, working hard for the man, and getting a promotion and then like retiring. So that was the formula. And there wasn't really any understanding of, well, what if what I want to do is on my own or starts from scratch? And that was considered risky. So there was, yes. Right? Or insecure. So then there were all these micro moments of dissuasion. Well-meaning parents, I'm sure mine aren't the only ones, who really kind of just want to gently shove you into something where they're going to feel more relaxed about, you know, like, please go be a dental hygienist or something that's a little more secure or stable in their minds. And so I had no vision for how to value the work that I was going to put into the world, unless it came to me through getting a promotion or a raise. But if I'm my own boss, I don't know how to price my work, how to value my work, or even how to give myself a raise.
Yeah. As you mentioned, I'm Midwestern. I grew up in a family where I remember when I got my first job as a music therapist, and it was in a hospital, and my dad said to me, like, basically, like, that's it. Like, this is your job. You know, like, you're going to be here forever. And I was like, oh my God, like, no, I'll die. Like, I'll die if this is it. Like, oh no. And I think that my dad was very extremely traditional. He was actually a CFO himself. But my mom was a teacher. And she has an interesting background where she grew up on a farm in really rural Illinois. And she wanted to be a stewardess on airplanes. And her parents said, no, they were like, you can't do that. You have to go to college. And it sort of started this trajectory for her where she was denied what she wanted to do. And so I think that because of that, she was then able to support me in a way that she felt like she never got supported. So when I was in high school, as I was sort of coming towards graduation, I had really wanted to be a professional ballet dancer, which, like, I think in some ways, it's like, okay, you know, like that sounds not stable at all.
But it also sounds like, I mean, I can hear the argument my mom would be like, of course, we support you. You're really good. We want you to do everything that you can do. But that's a really tough business. And
100%. And it wasn't until my dance teacher sort of had to have a conversation with my mom. My dad wasn't like that involved in just being like, you have to let her do this, because Also, just to go back, my dad had lost his job when we were younger. He was an alcoholic. And that was like a very traumatic experience for my family because he was the primary breadwinner at the time. And so it also put into this mindset that like work is scary. It could go away. You need security. You should just take a job and stay with that job. And money can go away at any time. And so though my mom did, she was like very much wanting to support me to go out and dance. She would give mixed messages almost immediately about like, well, how are you going to make money? Is this, can you do this forever? What if you don't get an education? You know, so it's like you grow up with all of these mixed messaging. And I do think it's well-meaning. We want you to be okay, but they don't realize like it's not a supportive way. And then it actually creates these extremely divided mindsets that we try to overcome as adults.
Yes. Overcoming the divided mindsets. The other classic one is the sort of punk rock ethos of making money means selling out to the man.
Yeah.
And my art's compromised. And that's not doing anyone any favors either.
Yeah, I'm also middle-aged, like tail end of Gen X. And do you know Janine Garofalo, the comedian? And she was in Reality Bites. And there was an article, a feature of her in the Times, maybe like a year or two ago, because she was talking about like selling out and like how she'd never sold out. And I remember that message so strong, like in the 90s, like, you know, you don't sell out. But what I try to explain to people is like, but you also don't hide. I think people hide behind this idea of like, I'm not going to sell out. And hiding helps nobody. You know, it helps no one in the world.
Right. Hiding, I think, also kind of is a cousin characteristic to the sort of false humility of not wanting to promote yourself, even if yourself is your business. It's so self-defeating, but it's like so ingrained. It's like deeply uncomfortable to engage in.
Yeah, it's an interesting question and thought because it's like, how do we think about where our talent comes from, right? Or where our creativity comes from? Like, I think when I think about that question a lot, I'm like, I don't know. I think sometimes it comes from something bigger than me. That so when I think of self-promotion, I don't think about like me per se. I think about this thing that I feel like should be shared with the world.
I want to talk about that more. There's a couple of thoughts around marketing that you have that I think could be really paradigm shifting for all of the creatives I know. And one of them is this idea that actually your creativity is a gift. So marketing is basically you sharing your gift. And the gift comes from somewhere else. So you don't even necessarily need to take credit for it. Like
totally. Yes.
And then the other idea, and we can get into this now or later, but marketing without social media.
Oh, yeah. My favorite.
Oh, that sounds like relief. Can you even do that? Is that a thing? Please tell me it's possible.
It's 100% a thing. It's the most amazing thing. Whenever people ask me about it, I can talk about it for hours, just how transformative it was. So I've been off of social media since September of 2020. So 3.5 years now. And it was something that I had thought about, especially after the pandemic had started. I just started to realize, like, I'm not sure this is a really great space for actually communicating with people. And so I just made the decision to leave. And I quit social media, like I quit smoking. So I used to be a smoker in high school and after when I was a dancer and like a pack-a-day smoker. And then one day I just like quit. I was like, I'm done. And I quit cold turkey. And for the most part, I don't smoke, although I occasionally do, but not like that.
Okay.
But the same thing with social media. Like I left and there was never a like, oh, I'm really like wondering what's going on in that space. Like it just never came back to me. And I found a more like creatively fulfilling existence without being in that space. And it just, yeah, it was a revelation actually.
I think we kind of all understand what it does to us personally and also how mental health has gone down since social media has risen and our teens are not doing well with it. But I'm still like trapped in this idea that I can't run a business without marketing through social media. And tell me how to get out of that trap.
Yeah. Well, I think it goes back to what we're talking about mindsets, right? Like when we're told you can't be creative and business savvy at the same time.
Yeah.
That was a myth about social media that I felt really inspired to challenge when everybody would say like, oh no, you can't grow a business without social media or you can't thrive. And a lot of what we hear nowadays, more so related to like kids, is like, oh, you'll be left out if you're not on social media. So you have to let them be on social media. But again, it's just not true. And what leaving social media did for me was it helped me expand my mind of all the ways I could be marketing myself and thinking about what marketing is. And this is, I teach a whole class about running a business without social media. And this is what I teach people. It's like, once you sort of take something away, it's sort of like a challenge. You know, it challenges you to think about, well, what are other ways I can share my story? What are other ways I can be connecting to people? It also starts to make you think about the difference between quality and quantity. When I'm teaching this class, we talk about the experience that your audience or your customer or your client is having when they come in contact with your work. I'm like, so what state of mind do you want them to be when they discover you, when they are engaging with your work? Are we doom scrolling? And then all of a sudden I come across a $30,000 sofa that you're trying to sell me, like probably like very jarring experience for people, you know, like, and so when you really start to think about like, oh yeah, what experience do I want people to have? There's so many other things we can be doing to connect.
Just knowing that there's a whole class that you've built around this idea means that there's support and that there's enough like actual nutrition to sustain a class that means it's not just a flimsy idea. Like it's not somebody's fun notion that we can do it without social media. It's like, no, actually, and here's the framework, here's the armature, and here's the exercises, and here's the homework. And it's deeply, deeply doable and figure outable.
Yeah. And I don't want to say this to make it sound negative, but it is more work to run a business without social media, meaning like you do have to be a little bit more intentional because I think it's so easy for us to think that we're doing something when we like post and scroll instead of like, huh, stepping back, reflecting, really thinking deeply about people and connection and what we're putting out into the world. And I think that that is sometimes a hard mindset shift for people because especially in like the 21st century and the last decade as social media and digital marketing sort of rose to prominence, I think we were sold this idea of like everything should be easy and like a minimal effort, you know, like just put up your website.
Right. This frictionless idea of like build the funnel and, just catch rain.
Yeah.
But I think when you are more intentional about the efforts that you're putting in and maybe they're more concentrated and the impact is a little bit more measurable, if you were to gauge the quality of that time you're spending, you might actually enjoy it more than the sort of cheap, fast, get it task-oriented nature of getting your social media stuff done.
Yeah. I like to say it's the difference between like margarine and butter. Like I like to compare social media to margarine, like sort of this manufactured engagement where butter is like this natural, rich thing. And so it is true. It is far more rewarding. It's you learn so much about yourself, about other people, and it's a lot more sustainable.
So let's learn some more about you. You mentioned that your dad was an alcoholic and lost his job, and he's a CFO. And that's, you know, from our generation, that's what we tend to think of as stability. And yet alcoholism and losing the breadwinner in the middle of your life is the definition of instability. So how has that affected you?
Yeah. It's funny because, you know, sometimes people will be like, oh yeah, so-and-so has a drinking problem. And the way I like to describe my dad, who has since passed, is Don Draper. So if you ever watched Mad Men, like yes. my father was literally fired because he had vodka in his desk drawers. And this was back in the 80s that he got fired. He was like that severe of an alcoholic. And so the word destabilized is a great word to apply to growing up like that because it is so unstable. But I think it informed like everything about how I am. So he got sober in the 90s at some point and then never drank for the rest of his life until he died in 2018. He got sober, but he never dealt with anything. So it was like,
yes,
that's gone and he could hold a job and like talk about unstable. Like my parents divorced, but then they ended up getting back together. But my dad moved into the basement while we all lived upstairs. Like it was a really...
Okay.
Yeah, it was a wild arrangement. But when he died and I spoke at his funeral, I said, you know, like in a lot of ways, like he made me a really rich person because I learned so much about the lesson of compassion and the fact that like we are all just deeply flawed and nobody's perfect. And what do you do with that information? You know, like how do you incorporate that information?
Yeah. So just to bring this back to your present day life, then does that mean that your consultancy is led by compassion? And what does that look like in terms of the people that you're working with?
Yeah, I say my business consultancy is really about the intersection of business growth and personal growth with this realization that everything that we do in business, whether we're trying to make more money or we're trying to build a team or we're trying to market ourselves or we're trying to create this long-term vision and legacy, is really rooted in who we are as a person, right? So all of these mindsets, all of our history is the foundation of how we start to think about all of those things. So often when we can't make money, it's oftentimes I see a lot, especially in the design community, I think is interesting. Like we have judgments about people who make a lot of money and we're trying to sell to them. And that's really hard, that tension then. It actually keeps us from being able to sell to them. So it goes back to what have we experienced as humans that's actually like coming out into all of these business practices. Mm-hmm. And I say like the compassion part is because like it gets deep. Like I tell people when we start working together, like we're going to get really uncomfortable. There's going to be discomfort. Things are going to come up. I oftentimes end up referring people to therapy or couples therapy to digest all of these things that we end up surfacing through the business planning. But I'm able to sustain it and keep going with them because I can have a lot of compassion for what they're going through.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, clever listeners. We're getting excited for New York Design Week in May. This year will be better than ever. ICFF, North America's leading platform for contemporary design, will take place from May 19th to the 21st at the Javits Center in New York City. I'll be there, and I'm excited to let you know how Clever is collaborating with ICFF for Launchpad at Wanted, formerly known as Wanted Design Manhattan, and the Emerging Designer Showcase. Launchpad is an international platform for emerging designers that introduces new concepts and showcases prototypes of furniture, home accessories, and lighting. It is the best place for manufacturers to meet new designers, discover fresh ideas, and potential products to develop. The best of Launchpad winners will be selected by a jury of renowned industry professionals, led by yours truly. And they will go on to be featured in another edition of the popular Emerging Designers Showcase. I'll be leading the Emerging Designers Showcase live on the Talks main stage, where the five Launchpad finalists will have a chance to present their projects to our esteemed panel of professionals. It's always a really good time. So mark your calendars for Sunday, May 19th at 4 p.m. Both Launchpad and the Emerging Designer Showcase are presented with media partners Clever, that's us, and Design Milk, and with support from American Standard and Lumens. Visit ICFF.com to learn more and register to attend.
Those are the letters ICFF.com. Come by and say hi. I would love to see you there. Support for Clever comes from Wix Studio. Instead of reading you another, let's be honest, boring ad script, Wix Studio just sent me this wild-looking Alice in Wonderland-themed website to scroll through and tell you about. So, whoa. This is not the web I'm used to. There's something called mouse parallax, which makes it feel like you can go deeper into the screen. And as I scroll down, it's like I'm falling down the rabbit hole. And things are moving in depth and perspective. Even my cursor has morphed into a glowing little orb. There are all these no-code animations that make this place feel organic and alive. And Alice is wearing some pretty cool shoes, by the way. Okay, I know I'm mixing up my narratives now, but we are definitely not in Kansas anymore. Your turn to go down the rabbit hole. Build your next web project on Wix Studio, the platform for agencies and enterprises. So this is where your background I find so fascinating. Let's just start from the ballerina years, because that's creative in and of itself. But then there's more science and creativity that comes together into this beautiful explosion of really interesting background. So take me there.
Yeah. So when I graduated high school, I left 3 weeks afterwards to go into a Joffrey ballet training program in the summer. This was the summer of 96. I went away, I did it, and I came back and I was like, I can't go to college. Like, I have to be a dancer. So I did. I dropped out of school. I ended up getting a contract with the Ruth Page Ballet, which was in Chicago, joined the dancers union, the AGMA union, and was sort of off to the races in the fall of 96. And I got a role in the Nutcracker, which was like the Ruth Page Ballet's big production that fall. And then I started auditioning. And this is interesting because talk about divided mindsets. After Nutcracker wrapped in the spring, you go on audition tours and you deal with a lot of rejection. I had pretty low self-esteem at the time. I was always the tallest and it made me feel really insecure. So I went on audition tour and I was like, yeah, this is not stable. I need to go back to college. So in the next fall, I ended up, while I was still training full-time as a ballerina, going to Loyola University in Chicago. So I would go to the dance studio from 10 to 6, and then I would get to Loyola from 6:30 to 9 o'clock at night and do that 5 days a week. And then I would go to Starbucks on Friday evening and work at Starbucks Friday evening, Saturdays, and Sundays.
Oh, man. I can see where this is heading.
Yeah, it was rough. And I ended up getting mono. So by the end of that year, I was super sick. I actually had to like finish my studies remotely. Ended up pausing dance. But
the universe had to intervene. They were like, you can't continue doing this. We're going to have to shut you down.
100%. Yeah. So I did. I stopped. And at that time, I just sort of reflected and I was like, all right, I'm going to go back and I'm going to give dance one more try. But when I went back, I was really focused on getting into one company only at that point. I was really obsessed with Twyla Tharp, and she had set a lot of work on this company called Hubbard Street in Chicago. So I was like, I'm going to do this audition, and if I get it, I'm going to stay, and if not, I'm going to go to college. And I didn't get the audition, and I was like, that's it. And I walked out of the dance studio, and I never went back, which was like extremely dramatic and unfortunate, but I didn't have a lot of emotional intelligence at that time. And so I ended up just leaving. And at the time, I had played the bassoon in high school, and I was pretty good at it. There's a competition called All-State Honors Band, and I made the All-State Honors Band. And so I was like, all right, I'm pretty good at this. I'm going to pick my bassoon back up and audition to go to Berklee School of Music in Boston. And so I did. I auditioned and I got in, and that's where I studied music therapy.
Looking back now that we have the benefit of hindsight, dramatic as it was leaving dance at that moment, did you have any regrets or did you have to process?
Oh, yeah. I had tons of regrets and such an identity crisis, because even though I'd only danced professionally like 2.5 years at that point, I was in it really intensively all throughout high school. And it was extremely hard to like acclimate to the ordinary world. Like the dance world is so specific and it's so insular in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. it's so routine. Like you have a regimen, you have a routine. And then when all of that was gone, I really did not know how to relate because I, as a dancer, didn't go out. I wasn't social because you're so consumed with it and you're social with like your dance friends and like the theater and all of that. But it was extremely hard to process that identity crisis, which is why I didn't go back for a long time because I just couldn't. Like it was so painful. The irony is that I ended up going to school at Berklee in Boston. And while I was dancing professionally, I'd also gotten into a Boston Ballet training program. And I turned it down because I was too scared to leave Chicago, which is where I was living. And I ended up, once I moved to Boston to go to Berklee, I ended up going to the Boston Ballet to train on the weekends. And so it was like a nice way to sort of like digest that and reintegrate it into my life and like move forward with it all.
I'm happy to hear that because you can't have a bad breakup with ballet and like just have to like hide from it the rest of your life. You need to like, no, we can be friends. And I loved you so much. There's still a lot of good things about you.
Yeah, totally. And now my husband and I go to the ballet here in New York City all the time when it's in season. And I mean, I love going to it and I love that I have the knowledge and experience to like really understand it and to, you know, take it all in.
Yes, you can deeply appreciate the art form when you understand all of the energy and effort that goes into it, which is one of the reasons why I'm grateful that you're supporting creatives through what you do. But it's also one of the reasons why I think your podcast and hopefully this podcast is helpful is when you understand just the energy, motivation, dedication, effort, and grit that goes into bringing an idea from nothingness into reality, you start to have a lot more appreciation for all of the choices that were made, all of the artistic choices, but also a lot of the difficult and personal sacrifices that went into it.
Yeah, absolutely.
So from ballet to Berklee School of Music, and was this bassoon performing kind of what you were thinking or what was the program?
Yeah. So when I went there, I ended up becoming a music therapy major. And music therapy is essentially like a combination of a music degree and a psychology degree. And so that's what I studied. And bassoon was just like my principal instrument, as they call it at school.
At the time, this would have been mid-90s, late 90s?
Late 90s and early 2000s. Yeah.
Okay. How accepted is music therapy as a therapeutic modality at the time? Is it still like on the forefront or?
Yeah, at that time, it was definitely established. So you have to become board certified. And the biggest advocate for music therapy at that time was a doctor named Dr. Oliver Sacks. And if you've ever seen the movie Awakenings with Robin Williams.
Oh, yeah.
That's the story of his time up at this hospital called Beth Abraham up in the Bronx. And so he did a lot as a neurologist to really advocate. He was a lover of music himself. And when he started working with Dr. Tomeno, who was the head music therapist up there, he really saw it. And so he really took it upon himself to advocate. And I really believe did a lot for the field because there's certainly a lot of skepticism about what music therapy is and the impact that it can have. And so because of everything that Dr. Sacks was really engaged in, music and the brain became a big thing in the 90s. And that's sort of the path that I took. So when I was a music therapist, I really specialized in like Parkinson's, dementia, traumatic brain injury, aphasia, anything essentially that has to do with the brain. Mm-hmm. And music's amazing for your brain. Like we respond to rhythm without even realizing it because it's innate within us. We learn to talk through singing. So there are different parts of the brain. So if we have a stroke and we can sing, we can teach ourselves to talk again. We use rhythm to help when we have strokes or any issues with gait. So it's pretty phenomenal. And also working with dementia patients, the whole thing about dementia is that you can remember things that happened a long time ago, even when you can't remember what happened yesterday. And music is like embedded in our memory. And so people get so engaged with music when they have dementia because they can't think about it. Like it's part of our cells essentially. And so they just react and their bodies react and they're completely engaged and they can sing songs from their childhood all the way through without thinking. And it's really transformative.
Wow. that must have been really kind of transcendent to see too, and to see the power of it and the effect it was having on people.
Yeah, for sure. And I think it really was one of the times where, like, our brains are amazing. Like, when you really think about your brain and you really study it, like, it's this incredible thing that we have been gifted and don't even fully understand how it works all the time. And it can do remarkable things, which is why, sort of to connect back to stories that we tell ourselves, like, there's so much possibility. I got really into this field of neuroplasticity, which is like changing your brain, because that's a lot of what music therapy does. It helps with neuroplasticity. And we don't even lean on that. You know, it's like there's so much to lean on in that sense, and we're not even aware of it, or we don't embrace it.
So now I've got to ask, like, how does music and neuroplasticity play into your consulting business?
Well, I would say in a few ways. One, I always tell people that growth is all about change. So clients are coming to me because they want to grow a business. And anything that we look at when we think about growth is about change. There's a sort of cheesy saying that is, what got you here won't get you there. Meaning that, like, you have to make a change. And so it's about new. We have to tell ourselves new stories. We have to create new mindsets. We have to create new habits. We have to take different actions. And so, like, helping people understand, especially when people come to me and they say, like, I'm not a numbers person, or like, I'm not business. I'm like, you can change your brain. Like, your brain can change, you know, like, we're not fixed as humans. So really helping people understand that. And I do bring in a lot of personal growth to the work that I do in the business consulting with people.
How do you draw the line between, like, if you can change, you can change your brain, you can become a numbers person if you don't think you are. Maybe it's just telling yourself something different, but how do you work with your inherent nature and change yourself at the same time?
There are, in business, these tests, they're like strengths and weaknesses. It's even called Strengths Finders is the test. And I'm sure there's a lot of other ones like that. There's a lot of personality tests that come up in business. And I tell people the issue with that is that if we look at our strengths and weaknesses and we see them as fixed, we're going to have a really hard time achieving our vision. I think we all inherently, like, know what it is that we want out of life. I do think even that takes time for people to reflect, like, they haven't spent a lot of time. But once we do, we don't want to see ourselves as fixed in terms of, like, if we say something is a weakness, we do have to work with it. Like you were saying, it is about thinking differently, but it's about different habits. For example, I'm working with a client right now, not in the design world, but we had to have a real come to Jesus moment about financial planning. And she didn't want to do it. And she didn't want to look at her numbers. And we've been working together for years. And then she sent me this email and she was like, I did it. I had a conversation with myself last week. There were tears. I yelled at myself. Like, I just, like, had to come to terms with the fact that I can do this. And I've actually been avoiding it. And I think that we have to have hard conversations with ourselves sometimes. So to your point about, like, how do we work with those things? I think we have to become aware of them, but not see them as, like, limitations, and that we have to realize that we are responsible for changing them.
That makes it much more of an opportunity for growth than something that could be a potential roadblock. And when you have to work around a roadblock, a construct of a roadblock that is your own resistance getting in the way, you spend more energy going around it than you do just going through it, right?
Yeah, for sure.
Oh, but it does sound that, like, overcoming your own resistance is a big part of business growth.
It's a huge part of it. And I tell people a lot, like, the technical things that people want to learn, maybe like, how do you write a business plan or how do you create a financial plan? You can actually find so many free resources online, and there's tons of books available. But it's really about why. Why am I not taking that action? Or why am I not holding myself accountable? Or why don't I see myself in that way? Or why does this terrify me? That's what's at the root of all of those things.
How do you help people with that? I mean, it's one thing to, like, help them see it, but then how do you help them learn the new habit or keep going to that place that's really uncomfortable but is necessary?
I think I'm good at holding non-judgmental space for people and have a lot of patience. Like I have a client who is in the design space who I've been working with since 2016. And he had written me a funny email a few weeks ago because we just did a lot of technical things within the company. And it was like, took us years to get there, even though we had been talking about like, this needs to be done, this needs to be done, this needs to be done. And he finally did it. He finally took that step. And I think this goes back to compassion. Like there's a lot of times where I could be judgmental and just cut the cord and walk away. But I realize like change is really extremely hard for people. And as long as they're willing to take like the tiniest step forward, you probably know the movie, What About Bob? In What About Bob, Bill Murray gets the book, Baby Steps, the therapy book. And that's what I tell people. I'm like, it's just baby steps. It's not like change isn't about tomorrow I'm going to get up and I'm going to be a totally different person. It's about I took a tiny step forward today and I'm going to take another tiny step forward. And in 365 days, I'll have taken 365 steps forward instead of one giant leap.
I mean, it sounds so logical. But I can also see how being accountable to somebody like you, who's also non-judgmental, is helpful in the process, because I can wake up tomorrow and say, I'm going to take one tiny step, but you're not going to track my progress. So if I don't, it's just me. But anyway, I want to go back to music therapy, because you didn't stay there for long. So tell me what happened after that.
Yeah. So after that, I graduated. That's what brought me to New York. So I actually came to New York to do an internship at Beth Abraham, which is where Oliver Sacks was. He wasn't there at the time, although we did cross over on a case study when I was there as a music therapist.
That's kind of cool.
Yeah, it was very cool. So I came, I did music therapy for, I think, a year and a half or 2 years. And then I decided I was going to be a doctor, because there was a lot of resistance internally. It was still not very validated that music therapy was actually impactful. And I was like, well, if I become a doctor, I can really help like build this bridge, because I can speak both languages. And I love the brain. I was either going to be a neurologist or a neurosurgeon, because neurosurgery is also like really fascinating. So I ended up taking a year off. I went through like a very intense breakup and I was like, I'm just going to take a year off. I waited tables in Brooklyn, had a lot of fun. And then I went back to Columbia to get my pre-med, because I didn't have any science background. So I went back to Columbia.
Don't gloss over the had a lot of fun chapter, though. Yeah. And I ask this because I also had a lot of fun. And I frequently look back to those years and I harvest wisdom from those years. The adults in your life might look at you and say, why are you wasting your life? And it's like, no.
Oh, yeah.
I am having the best conversations I've ever had, even if they're at 4 a.m. and we've, you know, had something to drink.
Yeah.
And I'm meeting so many people because I'm less inhibited and I'm out and I'm doing things. And it was a very fertile time that you can't keep it up forever. But as a chapter, it's something.
Yeah, it definitely was. It was an amazing time. That was 2004. And I was in Brooklyn and I was in Williamsburg. And that time in of itself, like there's a documentary called Meet Me in the Bathroom about the music scene at that time. But it was like every night you were going out, and it was like the Strokes and the Rapture and LCD Sound System and TV on the Radio and the Yeah, Yeah, Yeahs and Chick, Chick, Chick. And you thought it would last forever in some ways.
Yeah.
And the thing about waiting tables is like you don't have any responsibility, right? So you're totally free. And we would be on our bikes every night going out. Max Fish was still open. The Lower East Side was this amazing creative hub. And it was incredible. I mean, it was also pre-social media too. So there was like none of that. Like there was a lot of debauchery. None of it was caught on camera. You know, like,
yes.
You were totally free. And also like, just to go back to leaving social media, I feel that again. Like I feel that freedom that I never felt when I was on it. And I think that freedom is so liberating. But yeah, that time, to your point, like it was so artistically inspiring. I ended up connecting with a music producer who also had gone to Berklee, but like 20 years before me, and he would bring me in to record on people's albums on my bassoon. And so that was also like very fun.
Yeah.
And just like something that I sort of have now in my pocket. And, but yeah, I totally agree. I mean, I think that that time, and I tell people that all the time, I've actually told people like, you should just step away and go wait tables for a year. And like, you know, cause he's like, well, I still need to make money. I was like, but the freedom that you have when you're in a job like that is so valuable.
Well, and I think that job, that time was also pivotal for you because you did go back to school to become a doctor, but then you'd already built this kind of community in the restaurant world that ended up being, even it, as unanticipated as it may have been, it ended up being a channel toward what you're doing now.
Yeah.
So this is another thing I always like want to remind people, like you may have a path, you may think you have a plan, but it's okay if it doesn't go linearly. Like you don't realize all that you're learning even on your detours.
Oh yeah, for sure. And I think that like the detours, I'll fast forward a little bit, but I think it's a good point. After I finished my pre-med and I was a medical researcher at Lenox Hill Hospital then too, I decided I wanted to go to Harvard and study with this certain person to do an MD, PhD. And this professor, her name was Dr. Ellen Langer. And she just had a book that came out. And a student of mine, Chelsea from Grain, had texted me this podcast. And she was like, this woman's amazing. And it was Dr. Langer. And I was like, oh my God. Well, one day in 2008, I had written her a letter and I wanted to go study in her lab. And she invited me up to Harvard. I met her. We talked, I read some of her work, and then it ultimately didn't work out. And it was devastating for me, but I would have never been a business consultant had I gone to Harvard that year. And I was just saying, like, you don't realize these things. It feels just so soul crushing. And I was so lost after that. But then because of where I was, I ended up becoming a business consultant, which created all of these amazing opportunities that I could have never envisioned. And I didn't envision at that time.
So I listened, and I recommend all of our listeners go back and listen to your personal story, which is episode one of your podcast, Cultures Within Capitalism.
Yeah.
Because I learned so much about you. And this isn't a full repeat. I think we're having a different conversation. But the piece of it that was really fascinating to me is you learned your business savvy on the job. You learned by doing. You learned because you were waitressing and the owner of the restaurant wanted to take a leave for to have a baby. And you assumed a management position. And that was where where you did a lot of your ground level learning. Describe that experience to me. And what were the things that you had to learn? And did you feel like you had to learn with a gun to your head? Or what was the experience like?
Yeah. So I'll just say, like, I had no idea what management was. I had no idea how to run a business. But I was pretty depressed at that point in my life, like really struggling in terms of like finding purpose and finding meaning. And I didn't know the path forward.
How old were you?
It would have been right after I turned 30.
30. And so at this point, you've also tried being a professional dancer, tried being a music therapist, tried going to medical school.
Yeah.
And so you probably were feeling like, I got to find something and I've tried all the good stuff. Like, what's left for me?
Totally. And I think what was interesting about that is that when I was a medical researcher, I was at Lenox Hill Hospital and I worked for this doctor, Dr. Ranawat. And he is like, legend. He actually like created the implants. If you get a hip and knee replacement, he has like the patents to those things. And so, and he was an incredible figure. But when you're up at like an Ivy League school and you're pre-med and you're working for this like world-renowned surgeon, a lot of doors open for you. Like he's a member of these like private clubs. You get invited to things. You know, it's like you go wait tables and people, especially in Williamsburg at that time, like treat you like shit. And it was like so ego crushing. And the fact that I had like over $100,000 in student loan debt where I was like, what am I doing? Like not only is my ego being crushed, but I have to pay back, like it was like $120,000 or something. And it was really hard on so many levels. And so like trying to find purpose, like what does this all mean? Like, why am I here? What am I supposed to be doing? Just were questions that it took me years to resolve. So when I was offered this opportunity to manage the restaurant, it at least gave me like daily purpose and also intellectual stimulation where I was like, okay, let me figure out what's going on with the finances. Let me figure out what is a company culture? Why are we wasting so much food? Why is nobody, you know, like doing their job they're supposed to do? Oh, because they don't have clear job descriptions. Like it was really the opportunity for me to figure out all aspects of how you actually run a healthy business. And I got really into it. I read tons of books. And so it really helped me realize like, these things matter. These practices really matter. They help you understand why you are or aren't making money.
So you were able to turn that business to a profitable one, yes?
Yeah. So we were able to turn it around. And within a year, we were able to offer everyone health insurance, pay time off. And so we were able to put all these benefits and good practices into place. And I was able to go to Congress and talk at a congressional briefing about the fact that like sick days are important or health insurance is important, like all these really good business practices. And it was at a time that was inspiring New York to put the sick days mandate in place and paid family leave.
Wow. So your work was not just helping that one restaurant, you took it national.
I think it goes back to this idea that we were talking about earlier, like, just facing possibilities, right? Like thinking about possibilities instead of accepting, which I think was sort of the rhetoric of like, oh, restaurants, you can't do that. It's saying like, how can we make this possible? And sort of using that as the compass to make decisions and take action.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
So catch me up to now. Why do you say you're a culture-first focused consultancy?
So when I started learning about business, I got really into learning about company culture. Our culture is essentially how we show up in the business. It's our behavior, it's our beliefs, it's our actions. A lot of times when we're talking about culture, we'll hear things like company values or our purpose. And in all my research and my practice as a consultant, it was true that you can have a beautiful business plan. You can have the most detailed financial plan. You can have the most awesome marketing plan. But if the company culture isn't good, meaning if like the behavior isn't good, if the mindsets, if we're not accountable to those things, it doesn't matter. And so when I work with my clients, I'm always talking about like, okay, we have to understand what the company culture is, and then we can build a plan for growth, or then we can build your team, or then we can put your financial plan in place, because the culture is really like the soil. Like if we think about a business, we can think of the culture as the soil. We can sort of think of our infrastructure as like the trunk of the tree. We can think about our plan as the branches. But if you're putting all those things into like soil that has no nutrients or is really hard and can't get water and everything it needs to survive, it's not going to work.
Well, that makes perfect sense. Do you find that you run into resistance? I think some of the things that are appealing about a business plan and a financial plan is that they're measurable. You sort of commit to a kind of formula, and culture is so not formulaic.
Yeah, it's not formulaic is right. Like, and everybody's culture is different. There might be some overlaps, but if you're doing it right, it should be so deeply personal to you that it is different from everybody else. And that's actually what helps you thrive. But you're right. I think we do have this tendency to be like, if I can't measure it, it doesn't matter, which is unfortunate. And going back to music therapy too, I think the reason that I'm able to think different about business is because music therapy thinks different about medicine and what healing actually means.
Mm-hmm.
And accepting that there are some things that we don't understand and that we can't sort of put our finger on, but we can see them and they're working. And the same thing is for culture.
So I know that one of the ways that you help people get clear on just how to grow their business and what they want their business to grow into is by asking them how they want to spend their days. Why do you want to spend your days doing this? What is the purpose for you here?
I think in some ways I have the most like interesting job in the world. You know, I probably meet with 30 different companies a month and that'll fluctuate and rotate like who those 30 different companies are. But I have such an insight, I think, into an economy in a way that nobody else does and into like the inner workings and sort of behind the curtain of that economy and a real understanding. And I really, just to go back to this idea of like art is the highest form of hope, like I think that if we can create good jobs and healthy companies and people's creativity can thrive, then we're going to live in a better world and the world's going to be better for it. And so I feel really lucky to be able to participate in that process. And I see so much. I mean, I've been through like marriages, divorces, childbirth, so many things that happen with people personally. And to be able to like witness all of that transformation is really rewarding.
Well, it sounds to me like you found your calling. You're in the right spot.
I think I'm in the right spot, but I'm not done yet. And I think...
No, because your brain can change and because you're looking for possibilities everywhere. That means you'll never be done. But isn't that the excitement of every day?
Yeah, for sure. It definitely is. And I think also like liberating being in middle age, because I think part of like why I was so existentially like depressed in my 30s is this idea. I thought it was like you found this thing and then that was like your path. And now I'm like, no, you can just keep changing until like the day you die.
Yeah, you just keep inventing or incrementally adjusting or course correcting or adding on. I mean,
yeah.
I was looking around at all the services and resources that you offer on your website. And in addition to consulting, you're offering a lot of information, but also some programs that anyone can sign up for, correct?
Yeah. So I have two main programs. The one is called Beyond the Feed, which is that program we talked about earlier about running a business without social media.
Yes. Oh, and I thank you for doing that. I need to take that class.
And then the other one is called Business Growth for Creative Entrepreneurs.
Oh, I need to take that class too. What is that? Yeah. I want to graduate from Ask Holly Howe.
This is the class that's sort of like a mini MBA. It's a 6-month program. It's really a 1-year program because you're in the group for a year, but the classes actually run 6 months. And we look at every aspect of your business from your company culture to your leadership to your long-term vision and goals to your financial plan, marketing and sales, operating systems, all the things. And it really helps people who have already established a business who are ready to set that long-term vision and say, like, this is what I want to do. Like, I'm all in and I need to do it all. And it's really actually where I met the design community. I was teaching it at Industry City, which is here in Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. And a lot of manufacturers in that area ended up coming to the class. And that's really where I got involved with the design community. And a lot of designers went through that program.
So it's 6 months, but you're in the group for a year. And is it in person? So is it only for locals or is it online?
Yeah, it's online now. So it was in person in New York, but once the pandemic hit, it's been online, which has been really amazing now because it's worldwide. So we have people across the country and then sometimes from other countries as well. So it's an amazing way to meet community too.
Yeah. Why do you choose creatives? Why do you kind of make sense to me, but I want to hear from you why creatives are your chosen niche in terms of this kind of work.
I mean, I find them really inspiring. I find the work that people do that I work with really inspiring. I want it to exist in the world. I want them to be able to engage with it every day. I think it's a total myth that you can't be creative and make a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
I think that if there's anything like I really like to prove people wrong, or like if people are like, that can't be done, I'm like, let me show you. I realize I like that. So I think like helping creative people see that like you can flourish and that this is valid, I think is something that inspires me.
Well, one of the things that I think would probably be working very synergistically in this relationship with you coaching creatives is that you're a creative yourself. And so often creatives go into these situations where they're invalidated almost because there's so many unknowns they're dealing with in terms of the creative process every day. It's almost like they're not taken seriously, or the feedback they're given is tinged with exasperation or frustration that they're not like sort of conforming to this measurable, rigid scientific protocol almost. If they did, that would kill what it is that they're doing on some level, and yet they still can put in the structure and the foundation. But it's really hard to do that with somebody who's judging you or invalidating you in the process.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think that that goes back to maybe like the culture of education. And I think people can be well-meaning and still do really damaging things. You know, I think that we can be well-meaning and give people complexes about not being numbers worthy. Or, you know, we just drive home that narrative that like, oh, that's the creative thing. Now we're going to do this real work or something like that, you know?
I love that you're there supporting and helping not just business growth, but business growth by way of personal growth. What's coming up that you're excited about?
I think there's a few things that are coming up. So I've just put together a group of guest teachers. We're going to do a two-day leadership seminar. It's the first time I've ever done this, because I also think a lot of times when creatives go into business, they don't see themselves as leaders. And leadership is definitely something that creatives struggle with, because we're never told we're a leader. We're never developed as leaders. And I'm really excited about that, because I think leadership can save the world. And I think we're in a time where we need leadership so bad. Yes. And we don't have great examples. And so I'm really excited to put that together and to do that as well.
That's amazing. I hope to take one of your classes or at least check in with you after them. And I'm so happy to hear that you think of creatives as leaders, because I do too. And I think we need more possibilities and more hope in leadership.
For sure.
Thank you so much for sharing all of your wisdom and your story and your personal challenges. This has been really, really nutrient dense and beautiful.
Thank you, Amy. And thank you for everything that you do in the podcast. I think it's such an amazing resource. And I also appreciate your approach to just the personal and like incorporating those life histories. And I love your phrase, nutrient dense. I mean, I think that's what makes that experience rich at the end of the day.
Hey, thanks so much for listening. For a transcript of this episode and more about Holly, including links and images, head to our website, cleverpodcast.com. While you're there, check out our resources page for books, info, and special offers from our guests, partners, and sponsors. And sign up for our free Substack newsletter, which includes news, announcements, and bonus content. If you like Clever, there are a number of ways you can support us. Share Clever with your friends, leave us a 5-star rating or a kind review, support our sponsors, and hit the follow or subscribe button in your podcast app so that our new episodes will turn up in your feed. We love to hear from you on LinkedIn, Instagram, and X. You can find us at Clever Podcast, and you can find me at Amy Devers. Clever is hosted and produced by me, Amy Devers, with editing by Mark Zurawinski, production assistance from Alana Nevins and Anushka Stefan, and music by L1011. Clever is a proud member of the Surround Podcast Network. Visit surroundpodcasts.com to discover more of the architecture and design industry's premier shows.
And that's what I tell people. I'm like, it's just baby steps.